Welcome to the Monday, April 17th, 2023 Planning and Community Development Committee meeting. I am the chair, Councilmember Kathy Holgarty, and I am joined by Councilmember Sean Quinn and Councilmember Thomas McLeod. Welcome staff. We have three items on our agenda, and we will start with 1A, which is an ordinance adopting the 2021 State Building Code. And Jerry is going to present. Thank you.
Hello, yes, my name is Jerry Height. I'm the building official for the city. We are adopting the State Building Code 2021 version. We did adopt it 2018. We're moving forward to the 21. Every 3 years, the state adopts a new code, the second and another edition. This is the 2021 edition. We're adopting it with the amendments, and it is basically a couple of slight modifications. The purpose and chapter, which is 1604.10, it's kind of wordy and I thought it was a little unnecessarily lengthy. It defines what we already do, so through the codes. The other change we made was in 1604.250 procedures applicable to all construction permits, where the last sentence says, neither the building official nor the jurisdiction shall be liable for the expenses entailed in removing or replacement of any material required to allow inspections. They have to provide access, and if they've covered it up, they've done work without a permit, or they've covered it up, then they have to, they're the ones that have to bear the burden of the cost. It's always been that way. It just kind of clarifies it, I would say. The other section we revised was 16.6. The state filing the state building codes in 1604. It's just we always had to have a copy of all of the permits or all of the building codes for the public. That's always, it's usually, I remember back in the day we bought an extra set of codes with the city clerk, and we put it in the city clerk's office. Now it's all digital, we're electronic, and so the community development department in the permit center has access to the public for all the codes, copy of the software that's mentioned. So basically that's what we have. So we're not making any major changes to the code at this time. We're just gonna, this document is pretty much the same document as 18. So we're just adopting what the state is adopting.
Okay, thank you. That's good to know. So it's basically the same thing, just these few changes. And we're going to start with Councilmember Quinn to ask any questions or comments.
No, it seemed pretty straightforward. This is consistent with what we did in 2018. The one question I had that on page six, and I don't know, I don't think this is the right place, but for those instances when one homeowner passes something to the next homeowner and there's potentially work done and it's discovered, I guess, where would that be reflected for clarity of who's responsible?
The owner is responsible for, see, that's what, during the COVID, there was a lot of work done without a permit. So when it transfers, it's kind of a civil matter between the two owners. Title companies should have picked it up, and they don't. And we have a situation that's kind of hard to resolve because people have to, in order to make it legal, they have to remove the sheetrock and show us what, and do as-built plans in order to demonstrate that it complies with code. So I just don't want this, the liability falling on the city for that.
You know, if you buy it, it's yours now. It's a challenge when you have an innocent purchaser in that situation. We try and work with people, but you know, life safety is our concern.
Sure. So I guess by the answer to the question, do we explicitly say that in any of our information?
Information or the codes? The code requires that the access be provided for inspection. That's always in that way.
Mm-hmm. I mean, I think it just talks about all work, you know, here's the work that needs a permit, and there's after the fact permits if you've done it without, and it doesn't really talk about the ownership of the house. It's more based on the building itself.
Right, but we're following state law that says, so I'm just wondering for more customer clarity and to memorialize it. And I know in some ways we don't kind of create language just for an instant, but during the pandemic, there were multiple instances. And for clarity, would we be interested in making it clear?
Pardon? What was that last?
You know, I guess the question is, should we be explicit that if you buy it, you buy it, and any, you know, you're taking on the liability from whoever sold it to you?
Yeah, because when I sign off on a purchase, I agree that the inspection was as accurate as it could be, and now it's kind of mine.
What if I sell my house to you as is?
I still have to have an inspection.
Yeah.
And I have to sign off on that inspection. But I mean, just for clarity, so we aren't then brought into a civil matter, can we have some clarity? I'm just throwing that out as some clarity.
That thing that we put in there is for the, it's kind of a, right now it's a complicated issue. We're running into a lot of these houses that were constructed or remodeled or additions during the COVID era. And we're currently trying to establish a means to an end with it. We've been speaking with the attorneys, and it's kind of an ongoing project right now. This statement is what the code says, you have to provide access. And I just don't want any of it coming back to the city.
That makes sense. I guess this is an outside issue, which we now discovered. So if you're working on it, then that's good to hear. I look forward to the outcome.
I think when we review our permitting materials, that's an opportunity for us to include language, like regardless of whether or not you did unpermitted work or not, once you own a property, you are responsible for that work. And we'll keep an eye on that when we're updating materials.
Thank you.
That's a great point.
That's all right. Because it's three streets.
Gary, the only question I have for you, the language that you've added under section 1616B, is that a pretty common and standard in all jurisdictions about the building official in another jurisdiction shall be liable for expense entailed removal? That's pretty standard then in all jurisdictions?
Yeah, that's the code. All the codes say you have to provide access for inspection. And if you're covered up, then you have to uncover it. Also, that 1616 is not correct. It should have been 1604. I just noticed that this evening.
Trying to follow, like, whoa.
This is pretty straightforward, and I'm okay with it.
Yeah.
So I don't have any questions.
All right, thank you, Rachel. Seems like every time I come in here, it starts sneezing. So say that again, because I was busy in my sneeze.
God bless you.
But yeah, thank you.
No, I'm good with it.
Okay. All right. I like the idea of the clarity. I also like the idea of it not residing within the legal language, because it might, then people might try to get around it. Mm-hmm. But to put it in the permitting language sounds like a really good idea. I think all of us probably have stories about something that happened that wasn't disclosed. In case, our case, it was the drain field that was on our neighbor's property. So we couldn't amend the drain field or work on it at all. And that was not disclosed to us. So, you know, we all get something somewhat we're along the line, I think. So, and of course we were we just went to sewer because there you go. In all its financial glory. Okay. And thank you for that. I like that. Because I'm sure that at that time, because it was years ago, I thought, well, that's not fair, right? And it isn't fair, right, that this was not disclosed. So if you have something that maybe will have people like it, that there might be something that would be good. Yeah.
Fire everywhere.
So are there any questions or comments?
Just one final question. I know this is what... Jerry mentioned that it's incorrect, 1604, and 1616 is fire code, and we'll make sure about that. Okay.
Yeah, that's an excellent one. So my question is, Kent, I am trying to remember if we can put ordinances on the consent agenda or if we have to do ordinances. It doesn't say it's going to... Doesn't say what meeting it's going to. What would staff like? Oh, it does right here. I was looking on the other. What do you guys think?
That's COW.
Okay.
What would you think of consent?
Well, I don't know that I can't remember if we ever do ordinances on consent. I guess we probably can't because we've got to approve them by voice.
Let me ask the expert, Ms. Humphrey will get back to me, I'm sure, in 2 seconds.
Question for my fellow council members. Do you think that this is, tee up enough questions that we should have it in COW, or maybe?
Well, what if you announce it in reports tonight? We have the subject, here's what it's about. We had recommended it go to consent, but if you've got some concerns, well, it's always be pulled from consent.
Yeah.
Do ordinance have to be tonight, though?
Oral says yes, you should go ahead and put it on consent.
Okay, so I will bring that up, and I will emphasize that this comes up every 3 years, because when I saw this, I was like, wait, this comes up, I've seen this before.
Right.
So that means that we've vetted this in some form before. Okay, so the, and I think the fire code changes might be the same.
Significantly different.
Now I'm remembering we got a whole bunch of strikeouts. Never mind, it takes up most of the package.
Yeah, in 3 years will be the same.
Let me refresh your memory here, Councilor Bulgardi. Go ahead. It looks like are you presenting or is Jerry? Great. Excellent.
I'll present. Yeah.
Please.
Well, thank you for inviting me tonight.
Yes.
And so we're going to be presenting the fire code changes, which is quite a bit different than what happened with the building code. Building code is really a housekeeping thing, really just switching the dates. And so one of the challenges that we had when we merged with the Tuckwilla Fire Department was we had an opportunity, not so much a challenge. We had an opportunity to take a look at the codes that utilized in the city of Tuckwilla and kind of look at it from a regional perspective. And the first thing that we found while looking at Title 1616 was that organizationally, the code is really written around chapters in the municipal code versus keeping all the topics in the fire code. The fire code has all of these topics. And so from a code reader's perspective, you would read the fire code about fire protection systems, then you'd have to go find it in the other codes in the Tuckwilla Municipal Code. And so one of the things we did many years ago with our contract agencies is we compressed all of those titles and put them all in the fire code. So when you're reading the fire code and the subsequent amendments to the fire code, it all reads similarly. You can easily see if there's any code conflicts. And it just reads a lot better. And someone doesn't have to know that there's another part of Tuckwilla Municipal Code sitting out there that might have some sort of requirement. So the first thing we did was we put everything together in one big basket. So we put all the fire protection system together, all the fire alarm stuff together, And by doing that, we ended up repealing several chapters of 1616 and throughout the rest of chapter 16. So the first thing we did was restructure it. So that's what caused a lot of the length of the document, is we're taking stuff from other chapters and moving it, harmonizing it into something that's much easier for the end, the code reader to read, and much easier for staff to apply the code if it's all in one spot. So that was the first thing we did. Once we had everything compiled, then we went through and started analyzing the code to see where the code was not consistent with what we're doing regionally. And so what we did is we took a look at that, and then we took out the parts that we felt really wasn't being done regionally, and trying to be more consistent with the development that's going around in other jurisdictions. If you build a building in Kent or SeaTac, you should be able to build the same building in Tukwila without much change, right? What we found was, in some cases, it was significantly different. The buildings that were being built in Tukwila had much higher elevated levels of protection. And really, we couldn't understand why the levels of protection were there, even talking to the historical Tukwila folks. It was just something that they did because they felt they needed to at the time. Much of the decisions were made in an earlier time before the Tukwila Fire Department really became fully staffed and had, many more people on the engines and had state-of-the-art equipment and response and all that. And so some of the stuff was just outdated. And so we took an opportunity to streamline things and make it much easier for development, because the buildings that were built in other jurisdictions should easily be able to be built here, right, without huge changes. And so we did all that. So we went through all of those changes. And in the end of the day, we found that the access requirements and the water supply requirements, which are core functions for the fire department, in both the Tukwila code and the codes that we use in the Puget Sound Regional Fire Authority, were for the most part the same. They were very, very similar. Some of the words were different, but at the end of the day, the access requirements were similar. And in those cases where they were different, we just harmonized them and put them together. So a lot of the changes that I'm making in the other four cities are basically the Tukwila code. We're taking the Tukwila code and incorporating it into our base code that we have in all our jurisdictions. So that was really good from an operational perspective. Just to note the significant changes that we've made. So sprinklers, currently in the city, any building that's over 500 square feet would require a sprinkler system be installed in. That's pretty low. That's extremely low threshold. Most cities start sprinklers at about 5,000 square feet. And that's where we're at. What we're proposing that we would do here is that we would start at about 5,000 square feet up to 10,000 square feet would be a trip. We look at things a little bit differently. We don't do just standard square footage. So for instance, if you have a 2,000 square foot building that is made out of wood, it would require more water than one that's made out of cinder block, right? And so we take a look at how the building is built and factor that into whether or not it needs sprinklers or not. And so if you're dealing with non-combustible materials, you can probably get up to about a 10,000 square foot building before you need to have sprinklers put in it. If it's a wood frame building, it's around 5,000. This is just kind of just some numbers to throw out. And so I just want to make sure you're aware that we are moving the bar. We are instead of having buildings at 500 square feet, we're going to be looking at buildings starting at about 5,000 square feet up to 10,000 square feet that will require to have sprinklers installed.
Would that include residences as far as stick homes?
We're going to get to residences in just a moment. Yep. Yeah. And so that's a significant change for sprinklers. Fire alarms is another one. Fire alarms, we have a very low threshold. So in some cases, buildings under 500 square feet could require sprinklers. I mean, fire alarms. And then the other thing that the code did was it required fire alarms to be retroactively installed at any time that buildings were sold or bought. And one of the things about the code is that the buildings that are built are code compliant at the time. And if they're code compliant at the time, unless there's a significant change to the building, those buildings are considered grandfathered because they were safe at the time that they were built. Because you can't have a moving target all the time. It's not that it's not fair, but it's very difficult to quantify those changes, right? And so we found in the Tukwila Code is that anytime properties that were bought and sold that were basically unsprinkled or met a threshold, they would be required to put firearms be put in them. And so what we recommended is that we're just going to fall back to what the state of Washington requires for firearms. Firearms are, they're good about early notification, but they also create a lot of false alarms for us. And so we have to go out anytime you have a fire system installed and you have fire detectors in there, every one of those can call 911 if they get dirty, right? And so we really want to put that technology in buildings that really have a life safety issue. And so the way we look at fire protection, we have property protection and we have life safety. And property protection is really what sprinklers are for. Make sure that once there's a fire, there's a building left, right, that they can remodel or repair. Smoke detection, that's really in a life safety situation. So we see those in institutional occupancies. We see those in assembly occupancies where lots of people. We see them where people sleep, right? We have them in all our bedrooms at home, right? And so those are really the core ones. And so we don't prescribe to put fire alarm detection throughout this building, for instance. We're all awake. We're not intoxicated. We're spread out through the building. There's lots of exits to get out. And as long as we have notification when the sprinkler system goes off, then we can easily get out of the building. What that translates to is cost of ownership at the beginning of the project. And then every one of these systems has to be heavily maintained. And so you have to have lots of expenses to keep these buildings. So what we're proposing is that we just go back to the state of Washington base code. And that would in most cases outside of institutional assembly or people that are sleeping, you won't find smoke detection throughout these buildings. And so it'll be a little bit more realistic to what the threat is to the folks and making sure that they're safe. And believe me, a sprinkled building, they're very well protected. I had heard a stat that there really has never been a death, fire or death in a sprinkled building just because they're that effective. So that's a significant change for you. And then touching on Mr. Pookie, his comment about the residential fire sprinkler. So the residential fire sprinkler ordinance, Tukwila has one, and it's a blanket across every single one. We're proposing that we change that and that we wouldn't have it in every single residence. So sprinkler ordinances are a touchy thing. You can either blanket them across everything, or you can make the development requirements so advantageous to them that the developers just put them in without forcing them to put them in. And we subscribe to the other one. And so in the other four cities that we work in, we don't have sprinkler ordinances, a carte blanche one based on any size. But we do have heavy trade-offs on hydrants and access requirements. And normally, if you're doing tech behind development, it's all about narrow roads and being able to put those back there. Well, if you narrow your roads, if you put sprinklers in, you don't have a turnaround, which takes up a lot of space. And the other benefit is you can have a further distance from the fire hydrant. And so those tech behind more than likely will probably have sprinklers in them anyhow, because they don't want to extend a fire main back there, right? Or they don't want to put a big hammerhead back there. So it's a different philosophy. We are very successful in getting sprinklers in homes. But again, it's the carrot method, right? You lead them to getting the sprinklers put in there. So in full transparency, we want to make sure that you're aware that that's what we're proposing to do. But great question. I appreciate you bringing that up.
So I'm not sure that it got answered. Is there a square footage range for single family homes? You're going to go to not requiring sprinklers if they're...
Again, it's not based on the size of the home. It's based on if they're too far from a fire hydrant,
yeah,
then they'll probably put them in because they're not going to want to do a main extension. If they have access requirements that the tuck behinds are classic for that. They want to have narrow roads because they don't have runoff issues. And there's a whole myriad of issues when you have
some issues that create that. But in the base code language, it'll say that it's not really required unless other stipulations.
Correct.
Okay. So I'm good with it.
Okay.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you for bringing this.
Your
it's good.
Question is answered.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Great.
So those are the, big core changes. The other one that I just want to let you be aware of is, and this started before the merger, the Knox boxes that we have on buildings, mm-hmm. The rapid access boxes. So the fire department in Tukwila was a regional leader. They started moving towards electronic keyways, which is the new state-of-the-art access key. And so the rest of the region has gone to that key. The one thing that we've added in the ordinance is a retroactive requirement that requires business owners or building owners, not so much businesses, but building owners to make the necessary changes to their lock boxes to allow us to use that new technology. Mm-hmm. So in full transparency, we just want to let you know that. And basically it's a year. They have a year to upgrade their boxes. And so in some cases it could be around $200 to $1,000. It just kind of depends on how old their box is, because some of the boxes are 20 years old. And so they're not very large. They don't meet our current standard. And then the last thing is they have to have this electronic keyway installed. And the electronic keyway runs about $170. That's easy. If they're a more current box, it's not going to be a big ask for them to do that. But if it is one that's an old box that needs to get a new box, then it could be somewhere up towards $1,000. So I just want to make sure that you guys are aware that is in our code proposal.
All right. Councilman Cloud.
I like how you have kind of merged the jurisdictions together, taking some that you found good in Tukwila, and then from the other jurisdictions adjusting ours. Because I have been told in the past some of our fire codes were too restrictive. So I appreciate the effort here to put us more in line with the south end here. I agree with what I heard and what I've read in here. I don't have a lot of questions to it, but I appreciate the effort and I like what you did. Thank you.
Councilor Quinn.
Sure. I will say also I like how you framed the trade-offs, right? Because it's not just a change if it's an access requirement. I mean, it just makes sense, logical. So I just have one question, which is when we change the language from fire marshal to fire code official, does that have any broader implications? And I'm asking you as the division chief, as a fire marshal, and I assume that the attorneys have looked at the language, but just wondering.
Yeah, it's the easiest answer to that is the stuff that's in the TMC always quoted fire marshal. Okay. The International Fire Code does not even recognize the fire marshal as the fire code official. Okay. And so when we make these changes, we're actually amending the fire code.
Mm-hmm.
And so it seems but basically, since fire marshal isn't a word that's used in the fire code and we're amending the fire code, I went back and switched fire marshal to fire code. So when you read it, you don't see fire marshal in a section of the International Fire Code. At the end of the day, they're the same people. In some jurisdictions, the fire marshal is it's the person in charge of the division, right? And then you could have a fire code official that's the person whose job is to rule on the actual code side of it. So they don't worry about public education and fire investigations and those other functions that the fire marshal does. They're just really worried about the code parts of it. So like Jerry, as the building official in the international codes and uniform plumbing codes, he's the official. So he's the building official, plumbing official. And so there are some other officials that we have, and it's very common in the international codes. But again, it's that nuance of moving it from a chapter in the TMC into amending the fire code. So just trying to get the language to read right.
Yeah, and thank you for the historical work, because I think we've heard different versions. So being able to go back and research and then propose this approach by not actually forgetting, you know, because one, it comes from a historical action, and then just like telephone, when you get to it, nobody can remember what was the justification. And as you outlined, we were a smaller jurisdiction with limited resources, and in order to have the type of fire coverage at the time, we had one approach. And that is the process of progressing, is that you learn from it, and then you have a national, statewide standard. So I'm
fine with it. I just want to make one other note. You'll see the verbiage of fire chief in there just occasionally. Mm-hmm. And really what that is that in some cases, the fire code official may not work for the fire department. Okay, if you think about like a county organization, the county fire marshal, they don't have operational duties. So they rely on the fire districts to do that. So why we have the fire chief in there is to make sure that the fire code official, myself included, check off with the fire chief if I'm making impacts to things that impact operations. And that just makes sure that there's checks and balances in there. So you might see it in there. There's just a handful of places where the fire chief pops up. And everybody's asked me why if that didn't get changed. And that's, again, that's the why. It's that check off between the operational and the prevention part of our business.
Thank you. Any other comments? All right, I'm going to make a statement. I'll see if you guys agree with this. I think that this one should go to COW because there's a lot of change and pretty substantial. Mm-hmm. And so I had, she had not, so this will be forwarded to the COW and then to the ring. Okay, next item is the discussion on the multifamily tax exemption. Before I start, I just want to address Mr. Pukki here and say that we have rules of conduct here, but those rules are to serve us. We are not to serve those rules. So what we do is you ask to be recognized. And also, it would be great if you could let me know ahead of time that you had, you know, you had something. I was thinking this is something that you're vested in because you've got a piece of property that, you know, could be affected by it. I'm guessing. So thank you. And those comments were very valuable. However, nevertheless, it's like asked to be recognized. So that way it's the rule of fair for everybody who's people.
Here's my hand.
Did you? I'm sorry, I didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And so I have to shift over here a little bit more so I can see you. So, all right. And then this next discussion might be a little complex, so we're going to stay real focused here. And it has to do with multifamily tax exemptions. And so I'm also going to say that sometimes we don't recognize people that are here only because of time constraints and just to get through the meeting because we want to get out of here before the... And I just don't want to, like, pull any fast ones on you. I just want you to know where I'm coming from. Thank you. So... the next item on the agenda is the multifamily property tax exemption, the MFTE, and we have a summary of that. The council's asked staff to revisit this, and we asked to move it up. It was in third quarter just because of the extreme workload of staff, and I want to acknowledge upfront. But we did ask to move this forward, and thank you for doing that. So why don't you tell us what you've got in this number?
Sure. So for the record, Derek Speck, Economic Development Administrator, and you introduced it, so I won't have to repeat that. So the reason this item is here is really to provide an opportunity for the committee to have a discussion and provide some direction as to whether you would like to continue working on the MFTE program. And if you are, if you're able to give us some direction about how we would focus, what areas we would focus in, I'll just very quickly kind of just give a quick touch on what's in the memo and in the packet. I know the council has looked at it, just for the record. So you'll see, for the multifamily property tax exemption, is a property tax exemption to incentivize development of multifamily housing. It's allowed under state law. And so you'll see on page 74 of the packet, there's a list of 8 potential benefits of this type of a program. That's not a comprehensive list. Those were just the 8 that I thought were the most largest or most relevant, but there could be others. There are three potential costs, so an MFTE, and there could be others that I thought these were the biggest, most significant three. And then there's some other considerations. And so, I listed five other considerations there. And then if the city does want to move forward with some sort of multifamily tax exemption program, under state law, we would need to identify a geographic area where that would apply. It can't be citywide. It would have to be smaller districts. And there's a little bit of a description in state law about how you look at that. But basically, that's one criteria we would have to have, is some kind of a geographic boundary as to where these would apply. But you could also add potential criteria. You could add other criteria. And so there's a list on page 75 of about six potential criteria. And so in attachments, there's one page on page 77 that gives you a sense of what the household income levels were if you wanted to allow an affordability criteria, because affordability criteria would allow a longer property tax exemption period. So you can see what some of the household income levels would be. There's a handout from the Department of Commerce about just what is this program, just the nice basics of what the program is. There's a memo that our community development director wrote about housing targets and MFTE, because we know that that's one of the potential reasons for doing it. On page 83 is a spreadsheet that I created to give you a sense of, with just an example 100-unit apartment complex, what would that exemption look like? So what revenues would the city still receive? And of course, the tax exemption would affect all taxing districts, but I'm just focusing on the city here. So these are just the city's numbers. And one of the key issues is, if the city approves a tax exemption, there's a, depending on how the projects get constructed over what time period and when that information gets certified and given to the county assessor, it really affects whether the city is foregoing property tax revenue or whether that is being shifted to other property taxpayers. So that's that line there, is what the shift would be or foregone revenue for that example project. And then there's a whole lot of detailed notes and assumptions there, so I'm happy to explain any of those. There's a state handout on the tax shift, what that is. And then the last attachment is just a comparison to our immediately adjacent cities who already have an MFTE program. And to try to give it on one page, I had to simplify it, so feel free to ask questions. The short answer is the cities around us all do have them. Seattle does not have it for just market rate. They have it for affordability, and they've attached additional affordability requirements. You get to see the basics of it. So with that, we're just here to answer any questions and try to help you decide where you'd like to go with this.
Okay. So I'm going to tee this up. I'll be asking this question. I'm going to make a comment and then have a question. We do have an interested party that is interested in multifamily tax exemption properties. And so if we were to move forward with that, what would be a proposal that you'd have? So that's my question. But first, I want to say, do you need to go over in detail any other part of this memo? Because a lot of it we've done over the years. Questions on either one of you to ask detail.
I had a question you asked. There is, so you said there is an interested party.
Yes.
And I had the question, how many are asking? So could they just speak to both and then focus on interested party?
Well, there's one in progress and one that has expressed interest. Could you speak to that?
So the city has had an MFT program, but we no longer currently accept applications. So the program the city has was focused on a core in the urban center, in the, basically if you're from the river over to almost the mall, not including the mall property, between Strander and 405. And the goal back then, the city's goal was, we had no multifamily housing at all. And the markets had told us they wouldn't develop. No one would develop because they didn't know what rents, who's going to want to live there, what rents will they pay, will it financially justify itself. So the city adopted the MFTE
We put very short time period on how long we would accept applications because the theory I was recommending at that time was, well, we don't want to create an ongoing tax subsidy. The goal is to prime the pump, get the market functioning, and then see where it goes. So you can always extend it. So the council authorized that. We got a couple projects that came through, and then we extended it another year or two for more applications. So today, the buildings that have been built with it, the 19-story building was built with it. The ones that Alliance did have been built with it, which is the one that was Marvell, now it's called Mariblue on Baker Boulevard, the 55 and older. Alliance used it for Holden, which is the assisted living on Andover Park East. And those were all done, they're all constructed. So Brandon's the one that manages like their annual certifications and all of that. And then Alliance is building a new one, which is the one you're talking about called PROS, and that's going to be where the Home Street Bank building is at Andover Park East and Baker Boulevard. And that one's going to be in all ages. So that's an example where the city attached a requirement to say, we'd like to see an all ages development in that neighborhood as a way to show the market, because we had 55 and older, we had the 19-story building, which is like a EB5, different type of funding mechanism. And then we have assisted living, which is a different type of whole financial structure. So we really still wanted to show the market. So that application period is over. So PROS applied. So they're approved. They still need to do the construction to get, you know, they don't receive an exemption until they're actually built and open and everything is what they told us they were going to do. And so no one else currently can apply. So that's what's currently going on. Now, there has been interest from the Tukwila South property owners to have a tax exemption there to bring in some multifamily housing there. So that's the one that's currently expressing interest to us as staff. You know, last year we had one on TIB for Terra. We worked with them a lot, but that project, as far as I know, is not moving forward at this time. So they may come back to us in the future, but we're not working on that with the MFT at this time.
So if there were to be a project for Tukwila Valley South that they're asking, what would be some of the parameters that we'd suggest that might go around? What might work for staff, knowing workload and reality and all those other things? What might work for staff?
So in the end, it's about, you know, what were the council's policies? What are your goals? So if you said, our goal right now, because there's interest from a property owner now that wants to move forward now, if you said our goal is to keep this as simple as possible, then I would say, okay, well then the simplest thing is just to basically use the current ordinance that's on the books. We just add a different geographic boundary, we change the date for application period, and let everything else stay the same. So that's the simplest thing. What that would allow is that would allow the 8-year property tax exemption, and which is the one that would be for market rate housing. I would also recommend, instead of just simply having what we were doing in the past, was we had the sunset clause of the year that we only accept applications, say, through December 31st of 2020, whatever. I would recommend that we would put some actual number of units as the sunset so that there's a little bit of flexibility on the timing, but that we also have some certainty about how many units in total. But that's up for discussion as an option. Now, of course, the council could add a lot more criteria, and we're happy to discuss any of those if you've got interest in any of the other criteria.
So, but it being market rate, and isn't there an overlay already on Tukwila Valley South for a lot of these types of things that they have to meet?
In terms of like the criteria
and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, they definitely have to meet zoning and.
Yeah, so there's some criteria that's there. It's not like they can just do whatever they want. So I think Brandon, I think you might accidentally unmute him. So
people.
I think so. I'm going to put something forward and then we can have discussion between the three of us. That we have an applicant that is asking about this. We have we do want to have housing within Wayzata growth management. And Director Gerloff has written a few things about that. Thank you. And we have a proposed parameter, something that I wanted to be really careful not to create a new workload on staff, which is why I said this. And so now, and so the ask might be to go forth and create this, or are we there yet? Or I'm going to ask my fellow council members, starting with Council Member Quinn.
Well, the thing that I really liked about this and the initial MFP program is we've kind of had a chance to learn from it. Some of it is the market piece. I think the simpler approach makes sense. Thoughtful, because there's a requirement for kind of a geographic identification. And I think we've always planned for growth in Tukwila Valley South. And so I think with that limited approach, it makes sense. Again, we learned from it. I remember when we were told somebody's going to build down here. And then we got the 19-story proposal. And then that led to other pieces. Some of the considerations around kind of access to transit and other things. There were other kind of considerations, but being intentional about the where we kind of assume the growth will go, and the unit size makes sense. That way, it's it is not open ended, and we kind of have a sense of what we will see versus. You're granted this authority, and then, you know, maybe you don't maximize it. And so I'm kind of comfortable with the approach. I did hear about Tukwila Valley South having an interest in kind of between kind of corporate building and also residents. And so it's kind of a mixed use development. So I'm comfortable in the simplified version. And the kind of geographic requirement that goes with it.
Thank you. Councilman McLeod.
One of the questions I have, I don't know if you want to answer this now or after more conversation, what other tools do we have that would invite or incentivize builders to come and build? I know that we have growth targets that we're supposed to be shooting for. If we don't reach those, I'm not sure there's consequences based on my meetings at the growth management planning. But we still have an outcry for housing, market rate, affordable housing, that we hear all the time. And so amidst that backdrop, I want to reach out and kind of meet a developer in the middle. I like the simplified approach that you spoke to, that Sean alluded to. I think that's a good way to go. I would be curious. What would a builder or a developer be looking for along this line? I would like to hear the answer to that question. Maybe they're not asking for a lot. Maybe they're not asking for too much, but we've only gone so far. But I do like, and I've mentioned this to you before, Derek, that development over in White Center called Greenbridge is, I really think, an excellent development. It's in through King County Housing that's got assisted living, market rate, and you walk down the street, you can't tell one from the other. I think that's a really good development, and I'd like to see, you know, us kind of lean that way with what we want from developers to build. So I would be in favor of using this as a tool to kind of engage in conversations and see where we can go with it.
Just I want to add one more thing. Reading the kind of legislative work, there's a real possibility around preemption. Taking local jurisdictions' ability to have some tools to spur these kind of things. And so there are a couple bills that have died, but I'm not saying it's kind of a stick, but preemption is a stick. And then if you go other parts of the country, they've been preempted from the state to do certain things. And so I think that the growth targets as a consideration, but also the activity at the state legislature where preemption has been a topic of the last three legislative sessions. I think that is a reality and it's a fact that exists. All you have to do is look at the proposed legislation that maybe didn't make it across the line, but there are some. There are but there are some where I remember REIT was the third rail. Now it's a consideration, although it may not make it across the finish line. But I'm just saying there are preemptive actions if there isn't a sense of movement, while at the same time recognizing the need. So I just wanted to mention that.
Well, can I go back into the question? So if this is a tool in our toolbox to collaborate with developers to create housing in Tukwila, what other tools do we have?
Sure. So I come from kind of looking at things first. Well, how does, before government gets involved, what would the private sector just want to do on its own? Because ideally, that's sort of like, it's like if you can have a garden where nature grows on its own, it's better. So one of the key things that Tukwila can do is, if the better we are as a more desirable community, then the more developers are going to want to build here. So just being a desirable community with all of that stuff. So police, fires, like all those services are all really important. Good roads, good facilities, all of that. I don't want to sometimes we get focused on certain tools, and it's that basic foundation I think is really important. In addition to that, of course, the things that I hear a lot about from the developer community is the permitting. So having good permitting, which staff is working on, and just like what Mr. Napier was talking about tonight, like I'm so happy to hear about that, about having our fire code match surrounding cities' fire codes, because we have it in those conversations. You know, we have we won't go into that detail, but we've been in those over the last number of years on some of our housing, and that word gets out. So I think that is a very important. So if you were to ask me, would you rather, Derek, have a really good permitting system that's well-resourced and respected in the region, or would you rather have a tax incentive? I would take that permitting thing any day, because the timing of that, the predictability of that is very important.
But we're not there.
We're not there yet.
But they're working. So what would we take now?
So then, I think this is a very powerful tool. And so this is a tool, I don't want to underestimate the power. The Alliance told us we need it. In terms of other tools, there are some tools, and we could provide a little separate memo for the committee if you wanted. There are things, if your goal is to encourage more housing, there are like documents we could show you where it's, oh, here's the top 10 things cities can do to encourage more housing, like that. Some of them are more controversial, like inclusionary zoning. So like one thing that Seattle will require is, if you want affordable housing, if you're building certain multifamily housing developments, you have to include some affordability in some of those developments, or you pay a fee. If you can't build it in your building, you pay a fee to go into affordable housing. Like that would be a tool that like Seattle is using.
And if I may jump in, you know, honestly, we don't have a huge number of incentives in our code. A lot of our, you know, height and things are really by right. And especially if we're talking the Tukwila South area, that it was a very collaborative process to write that zoning code. So I think it generally meets what the market would want. So we do have a limited number of incentives to offer. So I think it's really important that we calibrate this incentive to make sure that we're getting the development that people like.
So, and as an example of other incentives, like Nora just mentioned, like the height and all of that. And we basically have provided those around the city and those types of tools.
So Brandon has his camera on, which makes me think he might want to say something. Excuse me for interrupting.
So, yeah, thank you. I apologize. I left my city computer at home, so I had to quickly log on with a new computer. But one thing I want to just, you know, you talked about carrots, incentives. The thing that we also lack in Tukwila is we don't have a lot of purely residential zoned land. And so, you know, if one thing to always keep in mind is, you know, many of our zones that we're looking for housing are also retail and industrial, allow some retail and stuff. Those properties are always going to be competing for the highest and best use, which may not be residential. And so an MFT can help it maybe line up. The other thing the counselor could do is to restrict and make some of those zones more housing first kind of zones, or require that there be, you know, some type of housing and any type of development on those properties, not just standalone retail. So I'm not saying, I just want to make sure that we understand that the counselor also has that zoning power. That's not a carrot, it is more of a stick, but that is something that would, that could be available as well.
Can I add,
yeah,
Chair, on that though? Clearly there's a need for housing in Washington State. Clearly there's a lot of people that would like more housing. The more housing is developed, yes, the prices of housing will come down the more there's developed there. But I do think it's important for the council to think about what, if you're interested in MFTP, at what scope, at what scale, because in a small amount, there can be a lot of these benefits. But the bigger of a program we do as a city, the more of that tax shift happens, or the foregone property taxes. And we do have a real cost revised service to new development.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And so, so if you were to say, hey, we as a city have a goal, we want to get to meet the housing targets. Like if we were trying to use this incentive just to meet those housing targets, I would strongly advocate hire a good financial analyst, so we like contract to get a really, what is our cost of service?
Mm-hmm.
Because what we wouldn't want to do is bring in a lot of housing, because the key thing with property taxes is even if there's no exemption, taxes on that new construction value, we get it the first year, the new construction value, and then each year after that, it's only going to grow by 1% basically. And so if inflation goes faster than 1%, residential in the long run has a very strong financial impact on cities. And the state needs to figure out a way to deal with that question. But it, I think it's not a major issue if we keep the total number of units to a certain size. That's all.
So I would like to sort of bring this around. This is something that council is asking for. So this is a little bit different model than most of the things that we talk about. So I want to ask my fellow council members and also ask staff. First of all, we are aware of your workload. We are aware that the MFTE is on the work plan. The global MFT, the globe being our city, the citywide MFT is on the work plan, and that that's going to be looked at in the third quarter. Also, I think that this is when we can talk more about carrot and stick and that type of thing and explore more of those options. But for now, we have a developer that is interested in moving forward quickly with this. And so I have two questions. The first is, council, my fellow council members, do we want to ask staff to take the next step on pursuing this MFTE for Tukwila Valley South for this particular developer? And then the second question is, staff, do you have, is this reasonable? I want to ask that. So first question, do we want to take that step? I mean, if you say, man, our workload's just over the top, then we need to take that into consideration. Right. So first question, council, would you asking?
So I'm making the assumption that the answer is going to be what you recommended. I will say yes, because this is a targeted one. I think we've talked about the considerations. I think we're all getting smarter and learning the process. So we can talk about these ideas of what the council wants, but specific to this conversation, we both just said the value is it's a small geographic approach and it meets a need that's articulated. I think that was pretty clearly stated. Yeah. There might be some other considerations, but that is not what we're talking about today. So I just want to be clear, and this is a product of, I think, understanding the tools, but also knowing that there are other processes in place to get to a place where our codes get examined. So I don't want us to go too far off of what this conversation was, and I'm very comfortable because it shows some best practices and ways that you don't make a decision that affects the whole city and could potentially affect the bottom line. I like the geographic piece. I think that's what we're talking about. And I'm comfortable with that, knowing that we've had those conversations before, but specifically to this question, the way it's proposed, that seems to make sense. And you said a unit number, that makes sense. So just being consistent so that we don't lose the topic that was on the agenda and it becomes some other discussion, which is not actually fully relevant to what's in front of us and answering the question. I just needed to be very specific about it because of the things that why this seems to be something we can consider.
So thank you for the focus, the renewed focus on this. What if it was like 400 units and that we were looking at and there's a proposal?
I don't have a number in mind, but to the geographic component, I would be a yes. But I like the idea that you spoke to, Derek, about a simplified method for the staff. I'm not looking to add a ton of work to the staff, but could we kind of have a kind of a broad frame to this specific geography that takes us into some discussions and see what that would look like? Affordability is important. So I don't know how that gets woven into conversation.
We're talking about the 8-year exemption.
Yeah.
So this would be market rate, which is also a need that we have for market rate apartments. So,
Yeah. In terms of workload, adding in the affordability requirements, that add a lot of complexity and time at this stage. So the easiest thing, so if the council, and we're not making a recommendation as to how to move forward, we're just saying if you want to move forward with that geographic area, if that's your recommendation, then our recommendation is to do it as simply as possible, is what we've talked about. So we could set some kind of a cap on the number of units. And what we would do is we would come back to you with proposed edits to the ordinance and a proposed map for that.
Mm-hmm. My answer is yes, and I would love to then maybe take some steps and then report back to us.
Mm-hmm. And then if there's any other areas that you want to down in the TUC or something like that, because this is really to us, it's sort of all the same area, then just let us know.
Sure.
If there's anything else that you want to add. I think that we're all supportive of that. So, I mean, we're supportive of that if they want to extend it to the TUC in some way. If that works for you.
Some rationale.
Yeah. The main thing is that we have an interested party in Pecola Valley South, and so that's the full.
Sure.
All right.
And then what we would do is, so we would bring this very focused step back.
Mm-hmm.
We would bring that back in the third quarter. We think that if that's achievable, if that's workable for the committee. Partly is that I want to get back to the economic development strategy. And when we work on this, it means we're not working on the strategy. So that's, we need to get back to that. We haven't touched that for months now. So we've got to get back on that. And but then what we would do is after that, if the council wanted to look more for other types of things, then we can open up that at your leisure whenever you would like us to look at those other broader areas.
After we finish this one.
We would focus on this first, and we wouldn't work on the broader strategy until we hear back from this committee later.
And we're in second quarter already,
right?
So that's just next quarter.
Well, the broad strategy that we had talked about, like for third quarter, we would push that back. So third quarter would be just this focused one.
Yes, absolutely. All right, so any further questions or comments on this? So it will not be coming back to the full council then for a while. We'll be working on it.
And we'll come back to you with a proposed amendment to the code, proposed map area, and then you'll decide for the council if you'd like.
Okay, so we have an action on that. And so the next item is miscellaneous. Any questions, comments?
I'm allowed to comment.
Well, we have a minute. Would you?
Yes. I like what Derek said about the cost of services on these developments on your last item. And the confluence is a good example where I'd like you folks, the approval is to have an idea of what that cost of services to them, because it's been a huge expense to the city.
So that's something that we could definitely talk about. I've heard a few things too. If you want to, if you want to look at the packet, there's some costs that are related to this Well, you and I can talk about that more. I'd be happy to have that discussion with you because, yes, it would be good to get a follow-up on the confluence and see what's going on with that.
Thank you.
Good. Any other things? All right. Then we are adjourned.